WFNI, 93 WIBC, HD2, Indianapolis.
AJ
from the racing capital of the world. This is the talk of Gasoline Alley.
For Alan Sir, winner of the...
Brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry. Skilled on principle, union by choice.
Contact wins it by less than one-tenth of a second.
Now, here's the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Donald Davidson and Kevin Lee.
To WLW and Barney Brenneman, Reg Blank and the Pirates and their anemic offense, 5-0.
Welcome to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan, WFNI Indianapolis. Along with Donald Davidson, the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, I'm Kevin Lee. Donald will be fielding your questions of a historical nature or nostalgic about the world's greatest race for the next hour. Full phone lines. When you hear someone hang up, jump on board. 317-239-1070. Good evening, Donald.
Good evening, Kevin.
Good evening, Kevin. Good to have you with us. And Dave and Marion called in about a half hour ago. He is ready, and he will bat leadoff tonight. Okay. Welcome, Dave.
Hi, Dave.
Hi, Donald. Hi, everybody. Donald, would you take us back to 1962?
Yeah.
To me, just a wonderful, two wonderful drives from close to the rear of the field, Eddie Sachs and Troy Ruttman.
Okay, yeah. You want them both?
If you would.
All right. Troy Ruttman had a very up and down career, but he always seemed to come alive at the Speedway. And if you look at the records, and I've used this phrase so many times, if you look at Troy Ruttman in 60, he's 20th. 61, he's 20th. And 62, he's 18th. So you think, well, okay, well, he was just an average guy then. Not exactly. He led the 60 race and the 61 race, and then in 62, and what you're referring to, he started on the outside of the 10th row in 30th position, and he came all the way up to second, and this wasn't pit stop shuffles. I mean, he was a strong second, probably from about, I think it was maybe 130, 140 laps or somewhere there. And so it was after Parnelli Jones had dropped back because of the loss of brakes, and Roger Ward pretty well had things in hand now. But Ruttman ran second and then had a engine problem or something which caused him to drop out. And so that's why he fades to 18th. But the other one was Eddie Sachs. We did talk about this the other night. Eddie Sachs won the pole in 60. Won the pole in 61, and he definitely aspired to be the first person to win the pole 3 years in a row, which still hasn't been done, not even Rick Mears. But he didn't have a very good morning practice session, and a wheel came off. And I don't know if this if it caused damage so they couldn't run for the rest of the day. I'm not clear on that, but I know there's film footage of Sachs coming down the straightaway with on three wheels, sparks coming out. I think it's the left front, I think. And then you see the wheel bouncing along. Whether he came back later that day or the next day, I'm not clear. But it came down to the fact that he qualified on the last day. He started 27th. And then he ended up third behind Roger Ward and Roger Ward and Len Sutton. And I think that his pit stops were quite long compared with the others. And I think that if you were to subtract the time in the pits and just do the time on the track, he actually ran 500 miles faster than the other two. But it's from the time the green flag drops to when the checker falls. Having said that, I don't really have a great deal more to add to it than that, except that Troy Ruttman, you know, had those wonderful runs, others, but I mentioned 60, 61, 62. I mean, that guy, you know, was awfully close to being a potential winner 3 years in a row. And then Sachs, who was not mechanically inclined at all, apparently had no mechanical knowledge, but he just, he just came in and stood on it. And the fact that he would have a second in 61 and a third in 62, there is a Something that's been on my mind for a while that it's probably as good an opportunity as any to bring in, and that is, and I'm going to be very careful to cover myself on this, for a number of years, quite a number of years, the legend of the Wood Brothers in 1965 has grown and grown and grown to their own embarrassment. And they came in 65, and they were brought in by Ford Motor Company to do the pit stops for Jim Clark. And it's funny that they would do that, because all of their pit stops then and to this day, almost 40 years later, they still use the dump cans. And at the Speedway, they were using the refueling hoses and so forth. But anyway, the thinking was that for sheer preparedness and choreography, that it would be, you know, special to bring them in. And I remember walking around the garage area, and it must have been the drivers' meeting day before the race in 65, and all I was hearing about was, the Wood Brothers are here, the Wood Brothers are here. It was a big deal. Well, anyway, they went ahead and they pitted Jim Clark and Bobby Johns, who was in the second Lotus. And statements have been made recently that not only did they completely revolutionize the way that pit stops were done at Indianapolis, but the fact there was there's a statement that I read in a publication that came out earlier this year, and it's because I think it's Glenn Wood, one of the Wood Brothers, is going into the NASCAR Hall of Fame. And in it, in one of these stories, it mentions that they went up there 2 weeks before the race to work it all out, which is not true, and that also that their pit stops, that they did two stops for Clark, which is correct, two stops for Bobby Johns, which is correct, and the statement is that the combined time of their four stops was quicker than any single stop that anyone else did. Baloney! Baloney! And the Wood Brothers, I've talked to Glenn, I think it was, and they're very, very nice guys indeed, and they just, they're sort of embarrassed by all of this attention, and a good friend of mine said that they've both made the statement, we got more credit out of doing less than anything we ever did in our career, and several things about it, and I'll come down with the punchline, which I figured out just recently, and that is that it's the only time that they used a refueling mechanism as opposed to dump cans. The other thing is that the Firestone tires had developed to the point where in 64 and 65, the winners, and in fact most of the cars, never changed a tire. So as far as the Indianapolis Speedway is concerned, the Wood Brothers still haven't changed a tire. So
they ran the same set of tires the entire race the winners did in 64, 65. Yeah. Wow.
And the other thing, too, was that up through and including 64, there was no minimum number of pit stops. And that's why Jim Clark in 63 got by on one stop, and everybody else started looking at that and thought, because, I'll back up a little bit. Right after the war, frequently the winner would do one stop, hard to believe. And then as the speeds went up, tire wear increased. Mm-hmm. And so it was necessary to come in for tires. And so they went to a second and a third stop. So by the time you get to the mid, late 50s, early 60s, it's three stops as standard. Well, after Clark got through with one stop only in 63 to Parnelli Jones's three, everybody started looking at that. And again, this is a phrase I've been using a lot recently, and that is that what's a great, you know, we can save time on pit stops. And then what's the greatest way of all to save time on pit stops? Don't make any, mm-hmm. or make as few as possible. So I think several people were looking to go either nonstop or at least one stop only for 64. Well, anyway, for 65, a mandatory two stops went in, and that's what the Wood Brothers did. And like everybody else, the cars would come in, And then somebody would quickly look over the tires, determine that they were okay, and they fuel them and they're gone. All right, now here's the figures. Clark made two stops. One of the stops was 25 seconds, and the other was 21 seconds.
Okay.
Fuel only. All right. In 1962, Roger Ward made three stops. I'm not making this up. Three stops. The first stop was 19 seconds. 19 seconds. And that included three wheels and fuel. The second stop, three wheels and fuel, 22 seconds. And then the third stop was another 19-second stop. And it wasn't a splash and go. Both of those, they changed three wheels. And what they did was, it was everything but the left front. The left front went through the whole race, but they changed the other three times. And 19 seconds, 22 seconds, and 19 seconds. And I think, and I got to remember what the other ones were. I think in 64, A.J. Foyt made two stops, fuel only, and I think his were 22 seconds and 21 seconds or something like that.
So I've always heard this story, too. I haven't heard the specific they did four in the same time as one, but I've always heard them described as a difference-making team. And certainly, as you describe it, they were good, they were solid, they helped, but that's far from revolutionary.
Right.
Where did this story come from? How did it evolve to that point?
That's the way it happens down south.
oh, that's right. I forgot. NASCAR invented safer barriers and everything else that goes along with it. So.
But the thing is, though, and I'll defend the Wood brothers. They never made any of these claims.
Yeah.
It's just legends down there of grown legs, and. But anyway, the thing about it, to kind of lighten the thing up a little bit, but I didn't make those figures up. And in fact, I did a bunch of others too. And just to kind of, you know, turn it around on myself, I just looked a bunch of this stuff up this spring. And it was very educational because I know I've made the statement several times in the late stages of the 82 race when you had the John Cock and Mir stops.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than go through the whole scenario, Mears came in first, and they gave him it was like a 16-second stop,
full
I think.
Load.
Yeah, sure, to get into the finish. Well, John Cock comes in three laps later, and they had him going in 11 seconds, Patrick Racing Team, under George Huening. And what they had done is figured out just the amount of fuel that he would need to finish. And, you know, the statement that I've made on numerous occasions, I think both on the air and written, is that as far as I was aware, you know, that was the first what we now call timed pit stop. Well, in looking a little bit deeper, I found quite a number that were fuel onlys that were much quicker. In 64, and I mentioned Foyt, and I think they did 22 seconds and 21 seconds, and then Frank Tannier is the guy that gets credit for that one. And then Lloyd Ruby was third, and I think, and he did two stops again, tires were fine, so fuel only. And I'm not sure on the first stop, but it might have been like 25 seconds. But the second stop, I think, was like 12. Because, and it was near the end of the race.
Hmm.
And so they had evidently figured out as well, we don't need to give them 75 gallons. You know, we've only got, you know, 20 laps to go, 30 laps to go, whatever it is. Just put in a splash. So anyway, back on the Wood brothers to lighten the thing up a little bit. Ford Motor Company bought them in. They had been at the 64 race as guests up at the north end. And saw the Sachs-McDonald accident, which is interesting on the number of people that were up there. Another person that was up there in the bleachers was Gordon Jarcock. So he'd actually come to the 64 race as a paying spectator and sat up in turn four. So, you know, how bad did you want to be a race driver in those days to see that and still come back and do it? Anyway, so the Wood brothers were invited to come in. And so having done it, well, they've never done a fuel mechanism stop before, so they went to see Foyt, who had driven their stock car, and they were asking him about pit stops. So he started showing them how they do it and everything like that. And so then after he's given away all of the trade secrets, and he said, what are you guys doing here anyway? They said, well, we're going to pit Jim Clark tomorrow. So anyway, but the thing about it that showed about their how thorough they were and the preparedness, there was, you'd put the fuel mechanism in, put the hose in, the nozzle, and then there was like a locking device. Well, it was very, very stiff. And so they thought, well, we need to free this up. So one of the lesser members of the team had to sit there for like an hour and work this thing back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. So, but things like that just showed that, I mean, they studied it and organized it and did very, very efficient pit stops. But they weren't as quick as Watson's crew did, plus changing wheels in 62.
Dave, thank you for the call. Good to hear from you.
Thank you, now.
Thanks, Dave. And all of that came out of Sachs and Troy Ruttman.
Well, you never know where we're going to end up. We never know where we're going to end up, but that was an interesting story. Thank you for calling, Dave. And Bentley in Bloomington is next with Donald Davidson on the Talk of Gasoline Alley.
Hello. Hey, Donald. I wanted to know if you've ever done anything with the rookie orientation, and then also you talk about Frank Lockhart.
All right. Done anything about rookie orientation?
Done anything with the rookies.
In what way?
Like classes or any kind of education?
Do you make them learn all the previous winners before they can race in the 500?
No, I tell you what. No, in fact, a couple of things. In fact, I was just thinking about this driving down here today. Now, the rookie orientation program, which is separate from the rookie test, that started in 1981, and for the first quite a few years, one of the banks was doing the Rookie of the Year award, which they still do, but they used to have a little press day, or press opportunity, and I was working for USAC, but I would go over and there would be like a little reception. And they haven't done that for years. But I mean, that's how I met Jules Deferrin in 1995 when he was a rookie. But the only time, I think, was I sat in on a couple of they used to have the classrooms. It used to be like a three-day thing. And they would come in, and there would be classroom, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. And typically it would be Roger McCluskey and He would give some tips, and then also I remember Steve Chassie was there one time, and in fact, this was 1984. I probably got a little bit heavy on the last one, so I'm trying to lighten it up a little bit here. In 1984, Michael Andretti was a rookie, and so his dad came with him to the classroom portion. And Steve Chassie had run in the 500 the year before, and he and McCluskey were pretty thick. So he said, come up into the room with me. So, there was Al Holbert was up there, and Guerrero, and Tom Gloy, and so and then a few others. And so Steve Chassie started giving all kinds of tips about how to watch the windsock. And the different tips that you can get. And he said, when you go down the backstretch, he said, there's a flag that flies, and you can get the wind direction. And Mario from the audience calls out, well, don't tell them everything. But anyway, there was just one. There was one time, and this would be 1995, I think. And I went and just sat in on it, and there weren't that many there. Oh, I know what it was. Every year there would be an honorary chairman of the selection committee for the Rookie of the Year. And I did that in 1995. I was the chairman. And so I sat in on the gathering, and Johnny Capels introduced me, which was very nice of him to do, and just basically said, if anybody has any questions about history, that, he could answer the question. Well, nobody had any, and I thought, well, they don't care. Well, because as a matter of fact, every rookie that made the field that year was a foreigner. Well, a day or two later, I was going through a parking lot, and I heard this, excuse me, and it was Alessandro Zampedri.
Okay.
And he came up to me, and he had all kinds of questions, and I thought, well, bless his heart, because I just figured, well, none of these guys care.
And that's not just for race car drivers. I think athletes in general are often not nearly as interested in their sport as we are as fans.
Well, it used to be that they were with drivers.
I think it probably was more with other sports. No, I guess I'm just talking about the athletes that I've dealt with in the last 20 years. Don't necessarily know their game. Don't know their sports.
I think that's probably pretty general. Yeah. I may be doing an editorial on things I don't know anything about. But my guess is that that baseball players in the 50s and 60s knew what had gone before, and now they don't.
I think that's certainly
race drivers. They're still there.
Dario Franchitti is
an example.
Great student in the history of the sport, and there are several others.
But, you know, Johnny Rutherford, for instance, I mean, he read all the books when he was, 14, 15 years old. Mm-hmm. And there were others they didn't think, oh, gee, I need to study this stuff. It was a natural interest that they had from boyhood. And a lot of the West Coasters that would come here, their hero was Rex Mays or Troy Ruttman or whoever it was, because they used to go to the races when they were kids. It was in them from the very, very beginning. But Zampedri was a delight. But sitting in that classroom, I mean, he didn't say anything. And I don't even know if I can remember all the rookies now, but there was Salazar. Christian Fittipaldi ended up winning Rookie of the Year. Andre Ribeiro was the fastest qualifier. And I'm going to embarrass myself. I know Salazar, Zampedri, and I think there was one other. And I remember being, DeFerrin, Gilles DeFerrin was the other. And so I felt a little out of it, because instead of them being, drivers that I had known through USAC and everything, I mean, it was a bunch of the whole rookie field was foreigners. So I thought, gee, I'd like to do this Rookie of the Year thing again. So I did in 1986. And who was the Rookie of the Year? Randy Lanier. An American, but enough said. So anyway, but no, I've never had anything to do with it. In fact, on Friday, for the last 3 years, that they have done a gathering of Tomorrow Stars, if you want to call it, it's the
Mazda lights, Road to Indy Symposium.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And so they've invited me to go in and just talk to them about history, and I've done three, and each under different circumstances, and I did one on Friday. And I think there might have been like three or four that really cared. Mm-hmm. There was one fellow that I thought was one of the coaches or a father, and it turned out he was a driver, and so he was asking a lot of questions. And then there was two others that I think turned out to be Gustavo Yakaman, and I didn't know what he looked like. And then the other one was this kid that was sitting in the middle with a big grin on his face, and he came up to talk to me afterwards, and it was Jeff Brabham's son.
Yeah,
Jack Brabham's
he's
grandson.
A USF 2000 driver.
Yeah, and living in Indianapolis. Uh-huh. So anyway, he was very interested. But honestly, looking into that sea of faces with probably two dozen, 25, 30 people, there was two or three that sort of really seemed to be interested.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for the call tonight, Bentley.
Thank you much.
More of your questions for Donald coming up. 239-1070 is the telephone number. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan.
From the racing capital of the world, this is the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Your host, Donald Davidson and Kevin Lee. 1070 The Fan.
Full phone lines at the moment. 239-1070 is our number. And Eric in Vincennes is up next with Donald.
Yes, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question for you, Donald, in regards to, we were talking today here in town that we thought there was a car owner from Vincennes that had an entry in the mid-70s. I was wondering if you could help me with that.
Usanna Purcell?
Okay.
Is that who you're thinking of?
Well, I wasn't sure, but I that sounds familiar. So I wondered if you could do a profile on him for
sure.
me.
Sure. Usanne Purcell was he was a partner of Grant King, silent partner. So I think he was involved in several cars where you didn't see his name. But I'm trying to think. There was one year where it actually was the Usanne Purcell special. In fact, it was Ken Schrader. I think that's the only time where there was an entry with his name on it. And after being a Grant King partner, somebody told me that I would get anybody in trouble. But I think he was a farmer. And I think that I don't know that his wife particularly cared for racing, so he kind of had to sneak the money in without her knowing about it. So I if that isn't true and I hurt anybody's feelings, forgive me. But I'll go off on a brief tangent here. There was one more. I won't mention any names on this one, but I was in the garage of a shoestring team on the morning of the 1978 race, and one of the partners in the team had been a sprint car owner for several years, and he had a partner who hadn't been around for a while, and the partner was in the garage that morning, and I said, "Are you part of this?" And he said, "Yes, but don't tell my wife." So anyway, but Usanne Purcell just very quietly gave Grant King money, and I don't think he had his name on the car or anything. So anyway, but the first time I was aware of him, he registered a car, not enter it for the 500, but he registered a car with USAC, right. And his proposed driver was Dale Coyne, and nothing ever came of that, and I want to say that was probably about 1981 or so. Anyway, in 83, he liked Ken Schrader, and now this is before Ken Schrader went to NASCAR, and he'd won a lot. You know, he'd done Silver Crown sprints and midgets, and Ken Schrader was sort of like almost like a Tony Stewart before Tony Stewart, where you thought this guy's going to go down there because he wanted to do NASCAR. I mean, as successful he was in open wheel, and he was from the St. Louis area, his hero was David Pearson. That was his favorite driver. So anyway, his ambition was to run the Indianapolis 500 and the Daytona 500 the same year. So he was entered for the 500, and it was a Grant King car with a stock block Chevy. And I was doing a story for it. There's a magazine called Open Wheel. And I was I don't know if it, how the idea came up, but it came to pass that I was going to do a story on Ken Schrader for Open Wheel. And so we met at Denny's out at Crawfordsville and almost to where you go around to go to Raceway Park. And so we're in the Denny's, and he shows up. And this was probably like late February, early March or something like that. And he came in and he sat down and he said, well, and he told me the story. He said, this is exactly how it happened. He said, I went through several emotions today because, he said, I came up to be fitted for the car. And he said, I come in and Grant King and a couple of the mechanics and Usanne Purcell were there, and they all kind of had long faces, and they said, Kenny, we've been thinking this over, and a stop block Chevy just isn't going to get it done. And he thought, oh no. So Purcell goes over to this where this tarpaulin is covering something, and he pulls it back and he said, so we bought this, and it was a March with a Carsworth in it. So anyway, that was Usanne Purcell, and then Kenny went out, passed the test, and then a tire equalized, I think was the term they used then, and he crashed, and they didn't have any spares, so that was the end of that. But the other thing was that in 2000, when Andy Hillenburg had the Sumer special, and there were a couple of people who were supposed to have stepped up to the plate and didn't quite step up to the plate, and some money was needed. And I believe that it was Bill Simpson and Usanne Purcell from what I heard, put most of the money into that. And so anyway, he was a very quiet guy, just stood in the background. And USANA, and I think I can tell the story now, was it was a USONA. And somebody told me, whispered in my ear, it stands for United States of North America. And so I asked him about that one time, and he looked, and he just sort of grinned, and he said, you better smile when you say that. And he didn't like the name. And apparently at some point he was off somewhere completely, nothing to do with racing, and he ran into somebody that had the same name, USANA. And he said, is that for the United States of North America? And they said, yes. He said, me too. He held it, took out his driver's license, said, I'm with you. But anyway, he passed away a few years ago, but just very much the typical sportsman. There was nothing in it for him other than just the satisfaction of doing it.
Eric, thank you for the call.
Thank you, sir.
All right, I'll sneak in a real quick question on Twitter. We won't make a habit of this. We'll see if we can do this one quickly. From Paul Davis at PD Lounge. About the 41 rear engine car burned in a garage fire, if it had raced, first of all, is that accurate? If it had raced, would we have seen more in the 40s and 50s before ultimately they came in 61 with the Cooper Climax?
Okay, the fire was one of three rear engine cars that Harry Miller built. Actually, there were supposed to be two, and there were two entered in 1938. One arrived just as qualifying was ending, and the other one didn't get there. In 39, they had three of them, and they ran on gasoline. Gulf Oil put the money up to build these cars. They were rear-engined, four-wheel drive. The engines were slant six supercharged. There were all kinds of technical innovations in the thing. The problem was that they ran on gasoline when a lot of cars were running on alcohol, and they had pontoon tanks. Nobody knew about fuel cells yet. So if there was an accident and one of those pontoon tanks got penetrated, guess what happened? The gasoline exploded, and you had yourself a fire. So a driver named Johnny Seymour was quite seriously injured, and then George Bailey, who was the first guy to actually qualify a rear engine car, which he'd done in 39, he was seriously burned in 40. In fact, May 7th, I think, was the date, and he succumbed to the injuries. In 41, those cars came back without the pontoon tanks on. And there was Al Miller, not Mr. Clean from the 60s, but the original Al Miller drove one. And George Barringer, who was living locally at that time, he was actually from Fort Worth, Texas, but he lived locally. And on the morning of the race, there was a fire in the garage area, and what happened was George Barringer's car was being filled with gasoline, and in another garage, either next or either in behind it or next to it, when the wooden garages, was Joel Thorne, one of Joel Thorne's car, was having some last-minute welding done. And this is probably like 7 o'clock in the morning or something. Well, they've got the welding torch out, and in the next garage, the George Barringer car is being fueled, and the fumes came through. I describe it like Pepe Le Pew's aroma in a cartoon comes in, and when it gets to the torch, there was this explosion, and about a third of the garage, a third of the eastern bank of the southern bank of garages. Burned down, and it delayed the start of the race by a couple of hours. Anyway, that car was destroyed, and they took the other one, and George Barringer became the owner of that, and now I'm getting into all kinds of complicated area now because he was fatally injured before the end of the year at Atlanta, not with this car. But the car then became the property of George Barringer's widow, and she ran it in 47 with the original Al Miller driving it. But there were three of those cars. There's one that has survived, and that's part of the Speedway's collection. So it's occasionally on the floor. It's not on the floor right now.
So really, to answer his question, they weren't significantly better performance-wise. So
no.
That's not what kept it from being another
No,
20 years before we saw all the rear engines.
Here's the thing. Rear engine cars were entered from 1937 until 1951. There was at least one entered in every of those years, okay, with as many as three. George Bailey in 1939 did 47 laps. That's the greatest distance ever completed by a rear engine car. So when Jack Brabham came in 61 with the Cooper, when he completed his 48th lap, that was the greatest distance ever completed by a rear-engine car. And, of course, he went the full 200 and finished ninth.
Okay. We'll sneak in Ryan in Nashville, Indiana, with Donald Davidson.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Hi, Ryan. Good.
Hey, there have been three drivers that have only had one leg that have driven in the 500.
Yes.
I just wanted to know if you could tell me who they were and what years they competed.
All right. Al Miller, who was the Al Miller that I just mentioned, and his years would be 1932... to 41 and then 47, because he came back after the war. He didn't make the race in 46. And okay, then the others were Bill Schindler, 50, 51, and 52, 26 and 50, 13th and 51, 14th and 52. And then the third one was Cal Nide, who lost his leg when he was 17. He was going to go to a Northern California College on a football scholarship, and he had a motorcycle accident and lost his leg. Oh. Anyway, he came back and ran in 53, 54, and 55. In 54, he was the second fastest qualifier, but he wasn't on the front row because he qualified on a later day. And there was one other driver that took a rookie test or part of a rookie test that I did not know until later that had one leg, and his name was Dan Murphy. He was on the track taking a rookie test in 1975. He's now deceased. Previous year, he'd been up at the Michigan 250 and finished seventh.
Hmm. All right. Well, thank you,
guys. Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan. More of your questions for Donald coming up, 239-1070 in the Talk of Gasoline Alley.
Donald Davidson, host of the Talk of Gasoline Alley, brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry, skilled on principle, union by choice, on 1070 The Fan.
Before we continue, Donald has a quick thought.
All right, two quickies about the original Al Miller with the one leg. In 1936, and this comes up a lot because people have witnessed it, or people, you know, ask about it, older people ask about it. This actually happened in 1936. Al Miller crashed coming off of turn four, and the car flipped, and the driver, he and the riding mechanic got thrown out, and the people were screaming. His false leg came off. He was wearing the leg, and it came off and went flying through the air with the shoe on it.
And
everybody
thought,
yes. Yeah. All right. Now, then the next one was Floyd Davis, who was the co-winner in 1941, told me this. He said, my first year was 1937. And he said, I was trying to get to know the guys, and I was sitting in, it was Tom Beale's diner, and they had wooden stools, tall wooden stools.
Is this having to do with a cigarette or anything?
No, no. But he says, we're sitting there one day, nothing much going on. And he said, we're all telling stories. And he says that Al Miller had a penknife, and he was flicking it into an empty chair. And he said, he's just flicking it, pulls it out, flick it, pulls it back, and then it missed. And it stuck in his leg. And he said he never winced. He just pulled the thing out and carried on with the story.
Man, these
and
guys
he said,
tough.
I thought, I said, boy, if these guys are this tough, I don't know if this is the place for me.
Nice. All right, let's check in with Mike in Vernon Hills, Illinois.
Hello, Mike.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi, Mike.
Good. Just one comment on the pit stops, Donald, in 65. I think after 1964, they outlawed pressurized fueling. So I think in 65, it was gravity feed.
That could be. Well, I think it was before that. I think it was already gravity feed, and I could be wrong on that. Because I think that when I know the Novi, I think, was fed in the late 40s with pressurized fuel, and I think it was done away with before that. Now, I could be wrong on that.
Okay, anyway, I called to ask you about Art Cross. I wonder if you could profile him, please.
Sure. Art Cross was, Art Cross was sort of like a Lloyd Ruby in that he was very well respected by the other drivers. And if you look at the records, you know, you wouldn't think of him as being one of the greats, but he was very highly respected by the others. He was an East Coaster, World War II veteran. It had been reported that he was injured in the Battle of the Bulge, and he was not, but he was hurt in Belgium. I asked him about that one time. He's a Purple Heart veteran, and he said no. He said that happened. He said, I was in England recuperating in a hospital when the bulge happened. But he was an East Coaster, if I didn't say that. He won the AAA National Midget Championship and won a lot of races at West 16th Street Speedway. And Frankie Delroy brought him to the Speedway in 1952 to drive for Ray Brady. And he finished fifth. And then in 53, he came back with Ray Brady. He had a problem getting qualified. And it was one of those things in those days where drivers and cars would change a lot. And he was having a problem with the Ray Brady car. Jimmy Reese was having a struggle with the Springfield Welding Clay Smith car owned by a lady, Bessie Lee Paoli. And so Cross got into the Springfield car and got going, and then got a release from the Ray Brady people, qualified near the back of the pack, and he finished second. And that was the year of the terrible heat. Vukovic won the race without relief in the Roadster. And Art Cross was second without relief in the dirt car on a murderously hot day. All right, in 54, he qualified and got bumped with that car. Then he qualified a car that Joe Sostilio, love to say that name, had troubles with. It was the third Ed Walsh car. And Bardal Special, dirt car. He started, I think, 27th and came up and led the race until he became overcome by heat. And then at the 300-mile mark, and trivia on that is that four drivers came in behind him. Johnny Parsons relieved him, Hanks relieved Parsons, then Andy Linden, and then Jimmy Davies. But anyway, so Cross had led that race, and then in 55, which is his last start, with the Ballinger Motor Special, he led that and was running second and had a problem late in the race. And he was living in La Porte by then, and had invested the money, done quite well, and then he just decided to stop racing. The last time he ever drove a race car was the Milwaukee 250. They'd extended it to a 250-mile race, and he was leading at 200 miles, which is what the normal distance would have been, and he made a stop which dropped him to fourth, and he never raced again. And for several years after that, I mean, Lou Walsh wanted him to drive the Novi, and Peter Schmidt wanted him to drive again. And he was very flattered, but he just stopped driving. And one time, a fellow named Fred Bruckner, who I think listens to this program every night, I believe, he and I went up to see Art Cross not too long before he passed away. And I would always wondered about the why La Porte. And in fact, it wasn't even La Porte; it was north of that, almost to the beach of the lake. And he said, you know, he said, I was a West East Coaster. And he said, I used to run Soldier Field a lot. And he said, hauling back and forth. And he said, I would see the people in the Midwest sitting on their porches swinging. And I thought, you know what, I could do that. And so he eventually moved there. And I think he worked for Whirlpool or one of the big factories in the La Porte area. But he was a very, very nice man and a hero to some of the drivers.
Mike, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
To Lawrence, Kansas now, and Raleigh is next with Donald Davidson.
Hi, Raleigh.
Hi, Mr. Davidson. How are you doing?
Fine, sir. Thank you.
I just got a couple comments. I just want to tell everyone how much I appreciate your program. I listen to it on the internet, and how much I appreciate Kevin Lee and Kurt Cavan's programs, too, as well. So I just want to make sure that I say that up front. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You did a wonderful job.
Thank you.
I don't know whether this is kind of a homer question or what, but I just want to make sure that sometimes they always talk about, you know, the Unser family being from Arizona and everything like that and how many wins they've got and California drivers. I just, you know, want to bring up, and maybe you can explain to me, I've actually talked to Johnny Rutherford.
Oh, is this about Kansas?
This is about Kansas.
I
and how he basically put his cowboy hat on and left Coffeyville, Kansas, and said, well, see you later, Kansas. Oh. And but, you know, we actually have, you know, Roger Ward from Beloit, Kansas.
Yep.
Johnny Rutherford from Coffeyville and Rick Mears from Wichita, Kansas.
You're doing my act.
It's not necessarily a trivia question. I just don't understand how come those drivers have always just never embraced the fact that they're from here. They always go, oh, I'm from Texas. Yeehaw.
We think of Mears from Bakersfield.
Okay. I'm from California. I've never really heard much about Roger Ward, but I definitely heard, you know, about Mears and Rutherford, how they've left. But I guess kind of some comments maybe from you, sir, that, you know.
Okay, I can
do it. What's the problem? I mean, we have nine winners.
We're going to run out of time, Raleigh.
Right?
Let Donald go ahead and answer.
All right, here's the answer. Rick Mears moved with his family when he was a little boy. It wasn't his decision. Roger Ward, same thing. I don't know that he was any more than born there. Rutherford was born in Coffeyville, Kansas. His father was in the Air Force and was stationed there. And I don't know how long
answers.
They were there. That's just happened to be where he was from. Pancho Carter was born in Racine, Wisconsin. Why? Because his parents were going up to Milwaukee and she started to give birth. So Dwayne dropped her off at Racine, went up and ran Milwaukee, and came back and got the baby.
Nice.
So Pancho's not from Wisconsin. He just happened to be born there. So it's the same thing. Johnny was born in Coffeyville because that's where his dad was stationed for a while.
Okay. All right. We can sneak in. Speaking of Racine, let's sneak in one real quick. We've got a minute and a half total. Paul, go ahead.
Oh, okay, from Racine? Oh.
Paul and Racine.
I'm wondering now what half we was born. Anyway, Donald, can you talk about the front row or the last row party? A little bit about that and probably its most famous driver.
I don't know what you would think about the famous last driver. I mean, Mario
Andretti. Mario was on it.
Probably. Andretti would take some topping, but, you know, Sneva's been on the back row. I think Fittipaldi's been on the back row because of crashing a car and doing a backup to switch to the back. Troy Ruttman are started last, but they weren't doing the last row party.
How did it originate?
All right, I think this is the 40th anniversary, and it was a press club started. It was Art Harris was one, and so it was. It for many years it was a press club function, and it's changed in its in the program a little bit. I mean, it used to be in some years it was quite lethal, always very very funny. One thing it's a constant. The drivers normally go, no matter who they are, and there are three checks issued for 31 cents, 32 cents, and 33 cents. And the only driver that's ever cashed theirs was John Mailer. And I did a really neat thing on the stage, very enjoyable for me. On bump day last year in the morning, we did last row experiences. Derek Daly was up there. Lynn St. James, Steve Chassie, Eldon Rasmussen, Bob Harkey. And we had a lot of fun.
Nice. Ron has a quick question. I think we won't even... Well, Ron, ask your question. We're 10 seconds over, but I think Donald can answer it in 10 seconds. Go ahead, Ron.
I was going to ask you, what is the oldest rookie driver to ever win the race?
Okay.
The oldest rookie to win the race?
Yeah, the oldest rookie.
The oldest rookie to win the race.
You'll say Ray Haroon was 39 years old, and that's the oldest driver that was a rookie. If you don't know, think on it. We'll get it tomorrow night.
I don't know. I mean, I can tell you who the rookies are.
My guess would be Jorge Thomas. Okay. All right. Think on that one. You can't look it up, and I trust you won't.
No, I won't.
You've got 23 hours to think on that. Donald will be back at tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. Thanks to all the calls. We'll talk with you tomorrow night, trackside at 7, and the Talk of Gasoline Alley is at 8 o'clock tomorrow night. Thanks to Craig Atkins, our studio producer. This is 1070 The Fan.